and also continue in the style that I'll mix in some things that the veterans have heard before and some things that they haven't, and including one Mar Makom that we'll look at together, just to illustrate some of the complexity of some of these issues. So we had been talking, it was a Ksuba Sir last night, there it is. We had been talking about the various circumstances under which a get can be forced, and trying to figure out when that applies and when that doesn't apply, and what is the active logic behind it. So just one point, which is an interesting one, so we'll just mention it, even though we mentioned this one a little bit during the Zman, so forgive me for that, but the Rambam's point that it's the mitzvah that is what takes away the problem of lack of ratzon, that because we say that there is a pintel yid, that the Jew wants to do what's right, so therefore he is going to follow the dictates of Chazal, even if he doesn't want to, even if he says he doesn't want to. So when we coerce him, whatever we do, so we are basically knocking out the Yetzirah. It's the Yetzirah that's stopping him from doing the right thing, and when you exert a little pressure, so you take away the Yetzirah, and he's able to let his true soul come out. So it's interesting, there was a machlokas between the Rambam and the Chavos Yar about this. The Chavos Yar is an Achron, lived a few hundred years later. The Chavos Yar, Rabbi Yar Bachrach, in his Tshuvas, he took issue with this. He said he doesn't think that's how it operates, because when you are applying this pressure, to put it euphemistically, to this individual, to give the get, so why is it that he eventually says yes? He says yes because of the pressure that, let's say the pressure is a physical beating, so he's saying yes because of what's happened so far, or he's saying yes because of what he's afraid is going to happen next? So presumably it's because of what he's afraid is going to happen next. Because let's say he knew for sure that it was over. He knew for sure he wasn't going to get pressured anymore. So then presumably he would still continue to say no. So says the Chavos Yar, you see that what's really motivating him is the fact that he's afraid of the next hit. If that's the case, so then it would seem that it's not that they knocked out the Yetzirah. The Yetzirah is still there. He's just afraid of getting hit. So then that seems to be essentially coercion. So how could the Rambam say that it's the Yetzirah that was knocked out of him? So says the Chavos Yar, it doesn't work that way. What's really happening is that it is the phrase rotzani that we get him to say that is essentially signing off on the fact that even if I were not going to get hit again, I would still give it. And that's what he means when he says rotzani. Now that's not really true, but says the Chavos Yar, it's good enough because it's reasonable. Because a reasonable person who's not getting anything out of this marriage would recognize that he has to basically give in. And therefore, it makes sense that that sentence is reasonable. And because we say, Dvarim Shabalei Veinam Dvarim, that even if he's thinking something else, but this is what he's saying, we go based on what he's saying, and therefore that's the whole function of Rotsani. So he says, that's how he understands it, which is essentially different from what the Rambam understands. Okay, so far so good? Shall I repeat it? Okay, basically, the Rambam was saying that he's getting the Yetzirah pushed away, and that it's the true him that's coming out. So what the Chavos Yar didn't like about that is he says, it's not that you've just pushed away the Yetzirah, because the only thing that's really motivating him to do it is the next hit. Because if he knew the next hit wasn't going to come, he's not going to do it. So it's really basically that he's being forced to do this. He's being forced to do this by this next hit. So that shouldn't be good enough. So therefore, to that, the Chavos Yar says, that's why I have to understand it differently. It's not that his Yetzirah is being knocked out. What makes it work is the statement Rotsani. And the Rotsani reflects the fact that he's going to give it even if he knew that he wasn't going to get hit again. And the reason that's believable is because it's a rational thing to say. The husband isn't getting anything out of the relationship anymore. He's just causing his wife heartache. So it makes sense for him to say that he's willing to give the get, and therefore we're able to go based on his statement. So that's how the Chavos Yair understood it. So there is a sefer called Elu Shekofni question. Yeah. Right, that the idea is that the Gemara has a phrase, as we said, not to offend Neo Hasidus. Doesn't mean that that sense of Dvarim Shebelev. That we talk about Dvarim Shebelev, it means that if we think you're thinking one thing and you're saying something else, so we go based on what you're saying. That if you make a statement, so we have every right to assume that that's your actual intent. If you're going to say later, well, I said this, but I meant that, in my heart I meant that, so generally we say, well, we don't care what you said in your heart, because Dvarim Shebelev, Einam Dvarim. So if the guy said, Rotzani, I want to give the get, so even though he'll say afterwards, I didn't mean it, I was until now saying I don't want to give it, so you know, I'm really thinking at the time that I don't want to give it, so we'll say, I don't care, Dvarim Shebelev, Einam Dvarim. We only go based on what you said, and you said you're going to give it. Now, if it was really a ridiculous statement, then we'd have a problem. We wouldn't really accept a ridiculous statement. But the Chavos Yair points out, it's not a ridiculous statement. Right? This is a guy who we think should be divorcing his wife. So since the statement on the surface makes sense, and he said it, that's why it counts. So there is a sefer written by a contemporary Dayan called Elu Shekofin Lahotzi. And in that sefer, he says that he thinks the Rambam is still correct. Just in terms of his explanation. And just to explain how, he says, okay, so yes, the person wouldn't give it if it wasn't for that next hit. But that doesn't mean the Rambam's explanation is wrong. He says, Mashal Mahadav Redoma. Let's say you have a friend, and your friend is kidnapped by a group of hooligans. And you get a bunch of your friends together, and you start wailing on the hooligans so that your friend can run away. Okay? Now, your friend runs away. Now, it happens to be that if you were to stop hitting the hooligans, they would be able to run and chase after him and capture him again. So the only thing that's keeping your friend free is the fact that you are continuously hitting the hooligans. If you'd stop, they'd capture him all over again. So that's what the Rambam means about the Yetzer Hara. That yes, the Yetzer Hara is the hooligans, and the Beis Din is the friends. So the Beis Din is stopping the Yetzer Hara. And yes, it's true that if they would stop hitting the Yetzer Hara, then the guy would go right back to his recalcitrance. Okay, but the logic is still the same. The fact is that because you're actively and continuously holding back his Yetzer Hara, that's why he's able to willingly give the get. That's his mashal. Okay, so far so good. So in that context, he says, this is relevant also to explaining something else. There is a machlokas harishonim, which the Beis Yosef discusses, and it's translated into a machlokas in the later generations as well. What if the person you're dealing with is, let's say, a convert out of Judaism? Let's say he's somebody who doesn't do any mitzvahs. He has rejected the entire religion. And this, by the way, is very relevant, because if you read a lot of the literature of the actual cases that happen, very often this is one of the elements. You know, that the husband has run off and become a Muslim, and a lot of the Israeli tshuvas, you read about that, he's become an Arab, become a Muslim. Shehu hisaslam, that's how they say it in the literature. Right? That's the technical term. Or he has converted to some other religion, so maybe you'll say, is the Rambam still correct that inside he wants to do the mitzvahs? He doesn't. He's declared he doesn't want to do any mitzvahs. He doesn't want anything to do with the whole Torah. So is that still viable? So some of the Rishonim, some of the Acharonim thought not. They thought that you can't use this technique on somebody who has rejected the whole Torah because you can't apply the Rambam's logic. And others disagreed. Others said, how do you know? How do you know that even somebody like this doesn't have a pentaliyah? Right? You hear stories about this all the time, that somebody could convert out of Judaism for whatever reason. And then on their deathbed, they say Shema Yisrael, they say something that shows there's a little bit of a connection there. So maybe it's still applicable no matter who you're dealing with. That no matter how much of a statement they've made in their lives that they don't want to have anything to do with the Torah, it could be that they are still possessing of a pintel yid, and therefore we should grant this logic viability anyway. So many achronim agreed with that. Many achronim said that this works across the board. It doesn't matter who you're dealing with. But in the Sefer Eilu Shekof and Lahotzi that we just mentioned, so he used his mashal to explain the other view. He said, why is it that there are some who think it doesn't work in this circumstance, if the person no longer cares about the Torah at all? He thinks because if you use his mashal, a person who's held hostage. So we know that sometimes it happens that a person could be held hostage, and he could decide that he likes it that way. I have to, yes, Adoni, I always say Chavshi, I like it this place. I don't want to change, I don't want to go free. And therefore, even if you were to come and to beat up the captors, he's just going to stay there. He's going to say, sorry, not interested, I'm staying where I am. So maybe that's what is being described here, that you theoretically do have a personality who could say, no matter what, even if you were to totally negate all the external forces, I still would not be interested in the mitzvos. And therefore, for that person, the Rambam's logic wouldn't work. So that was a discussion. But in any event, this idea that there is a mitzvah force that's applicable to people, that was the idea that the Rambam had, a couple of other Rishonim had as well, and others understood it differently. So what we wanted to discuss, we I think left off at this point, so we saw that the Mishnah lists certain cases where kofen lahotzi, and the question is, can you expand the list at all? So can you say that we can build on the list and say there are more? So the Mishnah, for example, most prominently, talks about, let's say there are certain physical ailments, like there's very bad breath, or other types of ailments that make it very, very difficult for the woman to be with him physically, even just to be in his presence physically. So maybe under those circumstances we say, these are the Mishnayos that appear on Daf Ayin Zayin Amud Aleph, maybe under these circumstances we say that it's not fair, she can't be expected to live with that, so kofen lahotzi. But do we extend it to other things as well? So this was a major debate. And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Kufn and Dalet, in Sif Chaf Aleph, so the Shulchan Aruch quotes the view that there are those who say that we only do those things that are in the Mishnah, or those things that are in Chazal. That's the view of many of the Rishonim. And the Ramah comments on that, that that's a more appropriate approach, that we have to worry that if we only do the things that we follow the Mishnah, only the cases that we find in the Mishnah, so then we know at least that this is a situation that Chazal addressed. But if we go beyond it, so then we have to worry that it's a situation of a get me'usa. It's a situation of a get that's illegitimately extracted and therefore not going to be kosher. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes 2 days about this. Some say we can go beyond, some say we can't. And the Ramah says it's better not to because we have to worry that we might have an invalid get. So there is still a major literature as far as what would be included and what's not included. And there are many cases that are discussed. It's interesting, just to give you some of the patterns, so a source that I don't think we ended up discussing during this month. So it's just interesting, just as far as how this is extrapolated. There is a Gemara in the Seches Ksuvos, on Daf Samach Aleph and Amud Aleph, where the Gemara talks about just the idea that when a woman gets married, so she is expected to have a better life with her husband and not worse. So says the Gemara here in Samach Aleph Amud Aleph, Ola imo v'eino yeredes imo, that if he has a higher standard of living than she does, then she goes to his style of living, she gets the better treatment. But if she's used to more than he's able to normally live with, so she does not take on a lower standard of living. So Ola imo v'eino yeredes imo. So why is that? So here the Gemara quotes the pasuk about Chava. It's interesting, just today or yesterday, I saw somewhere on the internet, somebody was arguing about does Judaism believe in polygamy or not? Does Judaism believe in more than one wife or not? And they were arguing basically, so what is the Iker marriage in the Bible? Right? So on the one hand, we know that Yaakov had several wives, and David and Shlomo had several wives, but other biblical figures, and most of the Tanaim HaMoraim as well, only had one wife. So somebody was arguing that Adam and Chava, that's the Iker marriage. And the response was, why should they be the Iker marriage? Isn't Yaakov more relevant to our religion than Adam and Chava? Isn't David and Shlomo more relevant to our religion than Adam and Chava? So here, this Gemara is one of the possible indications that really Adam and Chava do represent a certain paradigm for us, in addition to the fact that the Torah, it's in that context, the context of Adam and Chava, where the Torah says, Al-Ken Yazov Ish Asavi V'Yisimo, V'Davak B'Ishto. There are certain elements of marriage that are described specifically in the context of Adam and Chava. We invoke them in the Shavuot Brachos. So, you know, there is some textual support to look to Adam and Chava as the main marriage. You know, others will argue, well, what could he do? There was nobody else. You know, so there was only one of each, so you can't really derive too much for a prototype from them. But there are some sources that may indicate that that's the case. So this Gemara points to Chava as the model of marriage. And the Gemara quotes the Pasuk, Ki hi haisa ein kol chai. Right, so Chava was the mother of all life. So the Gemara picks up on that phrase, L'chayim nitna, v'lo litzar nitna. So she gets married to have a life and not to be anguished. So the idea is, the assumption is, the woman gets involved in marriage for a better life, not for a worse life. And this Gemara, which is kind of separate from the Gemaras we're seeing now, although it's conveniently still in Subis, but this Gemara is invoked by some of the Rishonim to illustrate some of the basic expectations of marriage. So, for example, some of the Rishonim over here quote this Gemara to make the point that a husband can't hit his wife. Right? That's not proper behavior for many reasons. It's prohibited to hit anybody. That's a pasuk in Chumash. It's a couple of pasukim in Chumash, maybe. But certainly included in that is one's wife. And in addition to the Isser, there's also the notion that that's not what a woman gets married for. She gets married for Chayim, not for Tzar. The Rambam in Hilchos Ishus quotes another Gemara that you have an obligation to love your wife, ohava kegufo, umachabda yos megufo, that he should love his wife as himself and respect him, respect her even more than he respects himself. Which is an interesting question. So we have a standard, v'havta l'reicha kamocha. Okay, so you should love your wife as yourself. How come when it comes to coven, you should mechabit her more than yourself? So presumably the idea is that men and women want different things. So you say, v'havta l'reicha kamocha, so we try to figure out, okay, what would I want, so I'll try to provide that for you. But very often, men and women have different tastes and things, so if you're going to try to mechabit your wife to the same degree, using the yardstick of what you want, so you're probably going to aim too low. So it makes sense that you should probably aim a little higher than what you would want, and then hopefully you'll get it right. So this Rambam is also invoked in the literature. There are certain expectations of marriage. And then the question is, so if we establish this, that he's not allowed to hit her, he's not allowed to treat her disrespectfully, and the like, so does that mean that if he does these things, is that grounds for kfiyah? So that's a question. And the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, this idea is quoted, this is also in Siman Kuf Nedalet, that there is a discussion about how inappropriate it is and how usur it is for a man to hit his wife, and how it's not the Jewish way, etc., etc. Whether or not it enters into the category of kfiyah, so then that's somewhat of a question, because some of the later Acharonim think for sure it does. But in terms of what exactly is kfiyah about, that seems to be the issue. Is kfiyah meaning that Tzar Mishnayos here tell us that you have to have a 24/7 constantly unlivable situation, where if you have somebody who loses his temper every once in a while, but the other days everything's nice, so then maybe theoretically somebody would be okay with that? Or do we say no, that this is, some say, this is a kal v'chomer from that, that if you can't be expected to stay with somebody who has a bad smell, then for sure, all the more so you can't be expected to stay with somebody who is violent or does other things in that type of category. So that's a discussion. Again, it's clear that it's also the question of whether or not it's grounds for kfiya. So that's machlokas in the Shulchan Aruch, and that's a discussion later post can have. Hi.
Does it have to be a that's because in the Mishnah the cases seem permanent as opposed to these.
That might be one possibility, right? So just a question of can we derive one from the other? So there are those who say for sure you can, you know, that I'd much rather be with somebody who smells bad than somebody who hits me. So it's a Kal V'chomer. And others say, no, it's not a Kal V'chomer, maybe because maybe the Mishnah is just saying that if there's a permanent situation, so then you can't be expected to live with that. But if it's a situation that runs hot and cold, so then maybe you take the good with the bad. That's one of the possibilities. It's also a question, and this you also find affecting the discussions today also, that we mentioned, I think, last week, of Reshefta's position that if they're not living together, then that's grounds for kfiya, which is a major, major, significant position in the halacha. So that also yields the question, should we assume that kfiya is legitimate if there's no value to the marriage? Right? If you have a marriage that doesn't add anything, so then she's not getting anything out of it, so then kfiya should be legitimate? Or is it only if there's something negative? Right, which is also apparently grounds for some debate here. Right? Do we assume that the issue is that the marriage is hurting her, and that's for sure grounds for kfiya? Or let's say the marriage isn't hurting her, but it's not, except in the fact that it's tying her into this marriage, but it's not providing anything positive, so is that also a automatic kfiya basis? So that also enters into a discussion on contemporary poskim that the Yerushalmi assumes that if he says "Eini zan ve'eini mefarnes," I'm not willing to support my wife. So then that should be grounds for kfiya, and there the Yerushalmi assumes it's a kal v'chomer. So should we say that that means because he's leaving her destitute, or because the marriage is providing her with no sustenance? Nafkamina would be, let's say she's not destitute. Let's say she has money coming from elsewhere. Or let's say the government is supporting her. So again, that's clearly not a good situation, but the question is just in terms of the grounds for kfiya. That's all a part of the discussion. So just to illustrate a little bit how complicated this is from one major source. So it's interesting, you don't find this referenced so much, but this is the Ramah, the same Ramah who writes in the Shulchan Aruch. I thought we might look at it together. This is not something that we did during the Zman, so it should be new for everyone. But we won't read the whole thing because it's long, but just to skip around a little bit. So the Ramah has a tshuva which illustrates a little bit the complexity here. That we mentioned last week, that what if the wife says, I find him disgusting. I find him repulsive. So what's that called? Mois alai. So the Rambam says that that's grounds for kfiya. That based on that, we can force the husband to divorce. And that's considered to be a very, very important position also for the contemporary debate. Because the assumption is that what the Rambam is basically saying, and this assumption might be incorrect, but the assumption is that what the Rambam is basically saying is that essentially anything goes. That if she says, I don't like him for whatever reason, then automatically you have kfir. So you can see why this is very significant in terms of contemporary practice. Because if we need to establish whether kfir is viable or not, so it sounds like if you follow the Rambam that anything is basically kfirable. Because the wife can always claim Mois Alai. So there's two major ifs there. First of all, do we paskin like the Rambam? That is a big, big question. Many, many Rishonim did not paskin like the Rambam. Some Rishonim did. There was more than just the Rambam. It's not a Das Yachid. Some big Rishonim did. But a lot of Rishonim did not. Very prominently the Rosh and Rabbeinu Tam. And the reasons why they don't paskin like the Rambam are twofold. Some of the Rishonim, it sounds like they fundamentally don't agree with the Rambam. And they say that this is not grounds for kfiya. That kfiya means there is some objective problem, maybe some permanent problem, meaning 24/7 and uncorrectable. So she'd have to live with this forever. Well, Mois Alai, who knows, maybe she doesn't like him today and she will like him tomorrow. So some hold that it's inherently not enough for kfiya. While other Rishonim hold that it could have been enough for kviya. The problem is we can't get involved because no one else can know that it's really true. That the problem with Ma'is Alai, this is the way the Tosfos Rid expresses it, is that, and the way many others express it, is that Ma'is Alai is subjective. So it's real. We recognize the subjective reality. And some of the Rishonim explain that it's basically a matter of taste. And just like people like different types of food, people like different types of people. So even if the rest of the world might think this guy's a great catch, if she says, I can't stand him, so then we can't argue with that. She can't stand him, she can't stand him. It's objectively true, even if we don't perceive why it is. So the problem is, what if she's not telling the truth? So you could say, what do you mean she's not telling the truth? It's up to her. It's by definition true. So it seems like, no, it's not by definition true, because there is a certain threshold in order to be Ma'is Alai. It can't just be that she's interested in marrying somebody else. If she's interested in marrying somebody else, that's not called Ma'is Alai. Ma'is Alai means there's something bad about this guy. Now, it could be subjective, it could be something no one else can understand, but it's got to be something bad about him. And if she's in love with somebody else, that's not good enough. So that's what some of the Rishonim were explicitly, they wrote this Beferish, Tosfos Rid wrote this Beferish, many of the Rishonim wrote this Beferish, that that's what they're worried about. They're worried that she's in love with somebody else, and therefore she's just claiming Ma'is Alai, and it's not true. So we can't force her to be physical with him because, okay, she says she can't be with him, fine. But we don't necessarily force him, get involved and force him to divorce because we don't know that there's actually legitimate grounds. So the Rambam doesn't seem to worry about that. And there's lots of explanations why he's not worried about that. But the Rambam doesn't seem to be worried about any ulterior motive. And it sounds like we take her at her word. Maybe because he does understand it so expansively that it would include even that. But whatever it is, the Rambam says, if she says Ma'is Alai, we're willing to be kofa on that. Now, is there any threshold for the Rambam? Maybe. So some say, for example, the Rambam's language is that Eino kishovi etzlo liba lesanoi lo, that she's not a prisoner, that she should be able to be forced to be physical with somebody who disgusts her, and therefore we force him to divorce. That essentially the physical relationship is impossible, so we force him to divorce her. So some point out that he doesn't just say it's up to her, he says that if he's sonuila, that if she hates him. So some of the Achronim read that as meaning, first of all, it's got to be a pretty strong level of disgust, it's got to be up there. And others also suggest that it's got to be something which is essentially she can't overcome it. That it's such a disgust that what can she do? She feels a hatred for him. And it's not something that can be talked out. It's not something that could have been talked into her in the first place. It's an instinctive feeling that she hates him, and therefore that's what can you do about it? There's nothing you can't force, you can't convince a person not to hate someone. It's an emotional reaction, and therefore that's what the Rambam's talking about. But that it has to reach this threshold of hatred, it's got to reach this threshold of something instinctive, so that's a discussion. Does the Rambam have this threshold or not? Also a question in both directions is, what if it's not so baffling to us? What if there is something that he does, or something that the rest of the world can see, that makes it quite understandable why she hates him? So does that change things? So you find that's far in both directions. There are some say that even the Machmirim would agree that if there's something we all can see that he does wrong, that's hateable, that we would act on that. And there are others that say the other way, that even the Rambam requires that. The Rambam's not just talking in general, but the Rambam also is assuming it's something that it's connected to something that we can look at. So you find that machlokus in both sides. But there are many who say that if there is something that we can perceive, then we would act on that. And then even those who say you're not kofer based on Moed Salai would say that that's different, that if we could all look at what's going on, that's something to act upon. It's interesting that the Ramah quotes an opinion from the Aguda, and come one of the Rishonim, the Aguda, not a political statement, a couple of Rishonim were political. You have the Aguda, the Charednim. So the Aguda and Yevamis, in his Kedushim to Yevamis, the Ramah quotes the Aguda that if the husband is known to see prostitutes, it is Roa Zonos, so then that's considered to be grounds for Kviya. And some explain, well, either Agud himself gives some reasons why this is. So some possibility is that it's going to cause a clear distaste in her for him. She's going to hate him because of this. And if that's the case, if that's the reason, so maybe that's what the Ramah is saying, that if there's a type of behavior, which it's understandable, we can see this behavior is going on, and it's the kind of behavior that the average person is going to feel repulsed by, so then that's going to be grounds for a kind of visible Moed Salai, and we will be kofa.
Isn't there a concept where the woman can, I guess, make a statement saying the other guy slept with someone else or something?
I mean, whether she has nemanis on this or not.
Yeah.
Right, that's a separate question. How do we establish this? But let's say sometimes it can be established, especially nowadays, it's actually easier than in the past. It can be established that that's happening without her testimony, you know, without her simply claiming it. You know, there can be ways to prove it. So that might be enough.
But we don't... Yeah,
if she just says it's dumb,
we don't let her claim, right?
Right. This everything that's going to happen here is going to be a part of a din Torah. You know, she's not going to be able to just claim this and he's going to say, "I'm telling you, it's not true." So, if there was no evidence and it's just based on her claim, yeah, Bezin's not going to act on that. Unless, again, you want to take it like the Rambam and say, "Stam Oisla is enough." But for the Rambam is saying, presumably there'd have to be some evidence. It's also interesting that one of the other reasons that the Aguda quotes is that he's going to use up all her money. He's going to use up all his money, and he's not going to be able to support her, which is interesting on a couple levels, because first of all, if it's about that, so then we should say, let's say, if he's a gambling addict, then all the more so that would be true. Or if he has any other very expensive habit. This might just be an example of an expensive habit. And also, what does it mean that he's going to use up all his money? But right now, he has money. So it's like Ben Sora Moria, we go to Yordan Lesof Daito, and go down to see what's going to happen in the end. So it's an interesting idea that that should be something that's going to be so significant. Ben, you had a question about that? Yeah. Okay, so this might be relevant to saying there's some kind of objective Moed Salai. So if you have a moment for some pilpul, just because we're still, it's already a week, but if you're still holding in a Shavuos mode, so there is an interesting point about this that's connected to Shavuos, a little bit pilpulish. You have to hold cup. But in the Tshuva Shaul Meshuv was written by Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson. He was one of the great Gedolei Achronim. He wrote like a trillion Tshuvas. He wrote many, 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 many Tshuvas. I guess that's why he called himself the Meshuv. He just wrote so many Tshuvas. So in one of his, he had many different volumes, and many different Maduras. He said Madura Kama, Madura Tinyana, Madura Tlisa. He just started over and over again. And each one has Chalakim within it, and each one has like a trillion Tshuvas in small print. So in the third Madura, Madura Tlisa, the Shaul Meshuv discusses that we just discussed on Shavuos that we were forced to accept the Torah, right? The Gemara says, Kafu Alayim Harki Gigas. So the Torah was forced on us. And the Gemara says that we could always say, you know, it's not fair. We're forced to accept the Torah. We didn't really want it. So Shaul Meshuv discusses a question that somebody asked that, well, but we don't normally say that by other things. That we discussed last week that when we force somebody to give a get when it's halachically appropriate, or if somebody is forced to sell something, so then we assume that they eventually decide to go along with it. That's what the Rambam says by the get, that they basically eventually are willing. Or when the Gemara says that if you're forced to sell something, even though the person forced you at gunpoint, but at the end of the day, you gave the item, they gave you the money, so you're okay with it in the end. So eventually, you know, we say that you are considered to be on board with this. So the Shaul Meshuv discusses as far as says no. That there's a difference between, let's say, marriage And let's say somebody forces you to marry somebody at gunpoint, where we say ultimately you're okay with it. Or selling something, where we say ultimately you're okay with it. And the case of the Torah being forced upon us. Because what the Gemara was saying is that if it was forced upon us then, and now we're obligated to keep the Torah, so we never have any moment of free ratzon. And that's what the Gemara is talking about. But in a situation where, let's say, somebody is forced to marry somebody else, so let's say a woman is forced to marry somebody at gunpoint, so then she does have a moment of free choice. Why? Where's the free choice? So she has Shalom Eshuv, she has free choice, because she can always get out of it by claiming Mois Alai. So he's basically understanding that Mois Alai is essentially a get out of card, get out of jail free card, that anyone can pull it at any time. So he says, what about the fact that many don't paskin like the Rambam? Many don't agree that Mois Alai is able to be invoked at any point? So the Shalom Eshuv says, no, but they would agree that if there is a clear explanation why you hate this relationship, then it does work. So if the woman was forced into marriage in the first place, she never agreed to marry him, so then she'll always have this way out, because she can always say, look, I clearly hated him because I was shoved into marriage against my will. So when it comes to marriage, you don't have a situation where there was never any ratzon from beginning to end. That's basically his point. So what do you see from his position? He sees that Mois Alai essentially is a get-out-of-jail-free card, and that the other Achronim would agree if there is something you can point to that makes it logical. So if a woman was married against her will in the first place, so then that makes it logical. Follow the word?
Does that only work if it was initially, or like even...
Yes, he says, in that case, only because she was forced from the very beginning. So then she'll have, there could be other things that work like that also, but in the case where she was forced from the very beginning, she'll always be able to say, listen, I never liked it. You know, I was schlepped into this against my will, so then she has automatic credibility for the Mois Alai. So you have those who say it's very very subjective, and those who disagree. So recently in the Shuvas Dvar Yeshua, I don't think we discussed this during this month either, the Shuvas Dvar Yeshua actually has a tshuva written to Rav Nosson Gestetner. We often quote Rav Nosson Gestetner's tshuvas in this year, but this was a tshuva written to him by the Dvar Yeshua, who was dying in Tel Aviv a generation ago. So he has a pretty machmir stance that he seems to assume that Mois Alai, which is explicitly against the way some of the Rishonim say it, that Mois Alai does have to connect to something that we can see, something physical about the person. The person has some physical attribute which doesn't make the list here in the Mishnah, but it's something that she might find disgusting. So if she says that, oh, I can't handle his hair color, whatever it is, so then that's what Mois Alai is. So in that context, he talks about, it's interesting because you see how also some of this literature, you have to know exactly what the context is. So he was talking about a case where the woman wants out because she says that he's megamgen b'diburo. So what does it mean, megamgen b'diburo? So sometimes it's an expression. It means the person is not really honest. He's not straight the way he talks. He mumbles. But he mumbles meaning that he purposely mumbles. That he, like Gemara uses it sometimes as a melitza, that a person purposely kind of talks in a non-straightforward manner. So sometimes it's an expression for dishonesty. So it sounded like, when I was reading this tshuva, it sounded like he was saying that she wants out because she doesn't consider him to be honest. But then at the end of the tshuva, it's clear that the way he was reading it is that he stutters. And so he's saying, okay, so she doesn't like that, but that's not an objective misa, and that's not something that you can see. So therefore, he thought it doesn't qualify as Mois Alai.
That's not something you can see?
According to him, it's different than we've seen from other sources. Other sources say that, you know, anything, wherever she doesn't like, she can basically say Mois Alai. We may not be able to act on it, but it's still at least called... So he says, no, he says it's not a physical attribute. He says that, which is a pretty machmir view. It's different than what we've seen so far. He's also discussing a different context, because Mois Alai comes up in some other contexts also, just so we note. So first of all, we'll discuss this more, that the husband can claim Mois Alai sometimes if he's trying to deal with a Cherem Derben Gershom situation where he wants out and she's not willing. And so the language is used there also, Meisa Alai. And also, it could come up even before marriage that, let's say, she's engaged to somebody. So some of the Rishonim discuss a cherim hakadmonim, that there was, at least once upon a time, a strict ban on people breaking off engagements. So the question is, what justifies breaking up the engagement? So there, the Rishon and Mordechai discusses that if she says, "I find him disgusting," so that's not something that we enter into this cherim. So there also, this is the literature about what's considered to qualify as ma'as alayah, so a person can break an engagement without any consequences. Was there a question before? Yes.
There's no statute of limitations on like a stuttering issue, you know, that someone has originally. 5 years, you know, after in the sixth year, all of a sudden she becomes so.
So that's an interesting question. So first of all, it's an important question. We have to distinguish between different terms. And we'll get more into these details also, that there are some times that we're dealing with something and we call it an issue, so we call it a mum, we call it a blemish. Right? So some women are justification for compelling a divorce, for kfiya, and sometimes they're also a justification for, even more than that, for what we'll call a mekaf tos. We'll say that the whole wedding was a mistake. So it depends what we're talking about. So if we're going to say that if it was true before the marriage and she didn't know about it or he didn't know about it, so then you might be able to say the whole thing was just a mistake and you don't even need a get. If it developed after the marriage, so then there was a marriage already, so you would need a get. But it might be a situation, if it rises to the threshold, let's say the Mishnah discusses, then it could rise to the level of kfiya. You could say, all right, so it wasn't there beforehand, so it wasn't a mekach tos when she married him. It was wasn't present, so she was interested in marrying him. But now, it developed now, so that should be grounds for kfiya. Some understand like that. That's basically the standard, that you have the same rules for mekach tos and for kfiya, but basically, and that's how some of the achronim write, that it all depends on when it happened. That if it was present before the marriage and she didn't know about it, so then that could be a mekach tos. If it developed after the marriage, so then it could be grounds for kfiya, but basically the rules are the same. Whatever it is that works for one, works for the other, it's just a question of when. So, but now we're really talking about a third category, where it's not that it's automatic kfiya, it's the ma'as alayah, it's a ma'as alayah situation. So ma'as alayah is presumably a lower threshold. You know, by definition, it's not the things that are listed in the Mishnah. It might be derived from the things that are listed in the Mishnah, but it's not the things explicitly listed in the Mishnah. But there, in that context, some write explicitly that because it's a subjective emotional feeling, that can be something that's cumulative, that it doesn't necessarily hit you at first, but eventually it becomes something that you can't take anymore. And that could also be, as we know, because the balance of everything else also has shifted. Right? So, you know, when people are in love, so then they don't care that it does X, Y, and Z. But if they no longer have such affection for each other, then all of a sudden the same negative quality which was there beforehand is all of a sudden going to be a much bigger deal. So some of the posts can write beferish that ma'as alayah could be something which develops cumulatively, which is also the flip side, and that's why that might be why some of the Rishonim say that you can't be kof on it, because if it developed out of nowhere, it could also leave out of nowhere, so maybe that's not something that we should say. And that's why in the Gemara, just we didn't get into this in such detail, but in the Gemara, when the Gemara talks about ma'as alayah, the Gemara is not talking about whether you're kof for divorce or not, the Gemara is just talking about her justification in not wanting to be physical with him. So there the Gemara talks about waiting it out a certain period of time. So perhaps the assumption is that if you give it some time, then the situation will pass, and then that's going to change. This also has major implications. Let's say the post can discuss, we'll have to continue this a little bit tomorrow because it's getting late, but what if the husband is put in jail? So do we assume that's automatic grounds for kfiya or not? And unfortunately comes up relatively often also. And then the question is also, so only if he's in jail forever, or if he's in jail for a long time, or if he's in jail for a short time. So how much do these temporary situations, how do you evaluate that? Sorry?
Has parole.
Right, so the question is also, where are we defining it? So if you're going to say, if he's in jail forever, so you say, okay, so then how could you be expected to stay married to somebody he's never going to see again? But if he's in jail for a shorter period of time, so then maybe you'll say, all right, so it's a temporary condition, and then maybe the wife could be expected to wait it out. And then where do we define it? Well, what if it's not forever, but it's 20 years? So she expected to stay married for 20 years to somebody she's not going to see for 20 years. So all of this is a part of the discussion. And then there's obviously the question also, well, what if it's not a question of time, but what if she's just horrified by whatever he was arrested for? So she doesn't want to be associated with that. So it's Riyesh, the truth about that. That's something that's also a part of the discussion. So there's a lot more to say about this. I hope it is true for the veterans that we're getting enough new material. We're also mixing in some, trying to give enough background for people who haven't heard some of the best before and new stuff for those who have. So and the proportion is going to get less and less in terms of the older material as we move on in the next day or two. But one of the things that I hadn't discussed during this month that I was wanting to get up to, so maybe we'll start with this tomorrow. And if you want to take a look at yourself, this is a one Mar Makom to look at. So this is a Tshuva Sarama Simon Lamed Vav. So it's very instructive about some of these issues, because basically the Rambam says can be kofra on Noy Salai, and other Rishonim disagree. And it's generally assumed that the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah also disagree. That the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah are right, that if she says Mois Alai, so she's not obligated to be with him physically, but says also that the Shulchan Aruch says that if he wants, he can divorce her. It sounds like he's not forced to divorce her. And then the Ramah has a comment also, which makes it sound like he's not assuming that there is kfiya on this. But it's instructive and it's interesting that this is not referred to so often. The Ramah has a tshuva about trying to figure out how various cases match up. So it's very instructive reading. He describes the whole situation here, and then talks about in light of the. Just he has a one line here. Just says, well, this line we'll do it together, and there's more tomorrow. Says this is again from the Ramah. This is very significant. The same Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch. So he says, "If a marti lahachnas roshi machlokus turei rabbeinu veharishonim veachronim b'meshakasvu b'tanius moedis alai yari ani peni ratzitu esmofi ki rabbeinu hadeyas mechmirim." That if I were to enter into the whole machlokas about whether you could be kofa based on Mois Alai, I'd be scared that my head would get destroyed because it's a big machlokas and there are many machmirim. So we see that if you wanted to figure out the Ramah's true feelings on this issue, so this tshuva is going to be a very big window into what he actually has to say about this issue and also about how various specific cases would match up. So basically, just to quickly review, what did we speak about today? So we spoke about the Rambam's position that it's the mitzvah that is operative, and the hitting it to get rid of the Yetzer Hara, the Chavos Yar, who disagreed with that, and said that that's not the case, because you're worried about the next hit, and therefore it's really based on his Rotsa Ani, and the fact that it's reasonable, and we gave the mashal that the Sefer Elish Kofim Hosi gave to defend the Rambam, and then we talked also about the Machlokas, whether the Rambam's logic could also extend to somebody who converted out of Judaism, and two different sides of that issue, and how that mashal could also explain the other side. And then we talked about the Mishnah's standard for what you're kofer for a divorce, and how the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, Shulchan Aruch quotes machlokas whether we extend it to other cases. The Ramah says better not to extend to other cases because it might be a get ma'usa, but still there is much literature about what's included within these cases. And we talked about how some of these situations would match up. We gave the fact that some of the Rishonim point certain behaviors as bad behaviors within marriage. Some point specifically to the Gemara in Samach Aleph that says that Chava, she is, got married for the purpose of Chaim and not for the purpose of Tzar. We had a little discussion about whether Adam and Chava are the paradigmatic marriage in Judaism or other marriages in the Torah, the best model. This is one source that points to Adam and Chava, and so some Rishonim say, so for example, if a husband hits his wife, so that's the kind of thing that the woman didn't get involved in marriage for, and the Ramah also emphasizes how asur it is, which whether or not it's in the standard for kfiyah, we weren't sure. We talked about whether kfiyah is based on a situation that's 24/7, or a situation that is bad even if it's not 24/7, and whether or not you could say a kal v'chomer from here to there. Also, whether it's just that the marriage is causing problems or even if the marriage is nothing. So let's say if he's not supporting her, but she's supported from somewhere else. And then the question of Mois Alai, that the Rambam's position that Mois Alai is kfiyable, and the Rishonim disagree. We saw some disagree because they don't think the whole thing makes a standard. Others disagree because we just can't know that it's really true. And then we discussed, are there standards and are there thresholds? We mentioned the Sholem Eishev, Sol Pilpul, about Shavuos, and what you can derive from there, from Matan Torah. And then we talked about Dvar Yeshua, so it's got to be physically observable. I talked about what you could learn from the question of Ra'a Zonos, and then we just got up to this Tshuvas Ramah, which, God willing, we will pick up with tomorrow, talk about some more specific cases, and then talk about the methodology. All right, I wish everyone a wonderful night. Should stay warm and stay dry. And not get caught up in any floods. And we'll see you, God willing, tomorrow.